Welcome to Tax Bites for Expats, the top tax tips you want to know as an expat. The podcast is here to help answer the common queries and concerns expats have when moving to or from Ireland. Complex taxes explained simply. We'll focus on the Irish and international tax issues to be aware of to ensure you save time, money, and stress.
Hi everyone, welcome to this episode of Tax Bites for Expats. Today we're going to talk with Olivia Wagner, who's the founder of 1040 Abroad. Olivia is a leading expert in US expat taxation, and he's also a best-selling author on the subject. He has over 12 years of experience in helping US expats navigate what we all know is the complex world of US taxation. He has in-depth knowledge and experience and is a respected authority in the field. So we thought it would be good to have him on because he is dedicated to helping US expats understand their tax obligations while also taking advantage of all the benefits and deductions available to them. So we've got lots to talk about. Olivier, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Thank you. So I think when we were trying to decide on what we might talk about today, I mean, really, there is so much. But what I'd love to do before we kick off and talk about, you know, the intricacies of US expat taxation generally is to for our listeners to get some kind of an overview as to your background. You know, why tax? The name, as some may have gathered, it doesn't sound to be from the US initially. I suspect I hear a French lilt to your accent. But yeah, tell us about your background.
Right. I'm originally from France. I moved to the US in 2004. I worked at Moody's Credit Rating Agency in New York. In 2009, I became a US citizen. And in 2011, I moved to Canada and only very recently became a Canadian citizen. And I had this idea of being location independent, of working for myself, which is something that is a lot more widespread since COVID-19. But back then, you essentially had to work for yourself, to work remotely. And as I moved to Canada, I was looking into fields in which I could do that. And taxation was close enough to finance, close enough to my skill set, that it sounded like a good match. I immediately became an enrolled agent. I founded 1040 Abroad and I became a CPA 3 years later.
You were busy, a busy few years.
Yeah.
So tell us then, why US expat taxation? What appealed to you about that specific niche?
Well, I'm good at playing with numbers, so that was a good fit for me. And also, Americans overseas are, you know, spread out all over the world. And they wouldn't necessarily have a US tax professional in their town to meet them in person and prepare their tax return. So again, back then in this pre-COVID-19 world, we're talking about 10 years before, that seemed like a good niche where people would be more inclined to work remotely.
Yeah. And that's definitely something that's become more common since COVID-19. So maybe when we're on that topic, I know one of the things we said we might talk about today was how the US wants to tax digital nomads. Tell us a little bit about what you see in your client space and what anybody listening today who considers themselves to be perhaps a US citizen and also a digital nomad, what do they need to know about or be aware of when it comes to taxes?
Well, the main thing is that the US taxes its citizens wherever they live. The only way to get out of the system completely is to give up US citizenship. As such, digital nomads will still report their worldwide income, but they would use the foreign income exclusion, which allows them to exclude their earned income up to $126,000. And to do that, they need to meet one of two tests, either be a bona fide resident of a foreign country, which normally wouldn't be the case of a digital nomad, or the physical presence test, which requires them to spend 330 days in a 12-month period in a foreign country or countries. So that's the test that digital nomads would heavily rely on. So that would be income tax. They would avoid paying income tax by using the foreign income exclusion. When it comes to Social Security, if they're still working for a US company, it will keep on being withheld. If they're self-employed, they would pay what is called self-employment tax with their tax return. The way around that is to be an employee of a foreign corporation. They can create a foreign corporation and then they won't have to pay US Social Security. Different people have different views on that because, unlike income tax, you're actually meant to receive benefits at retirement by paying Social Security. But that's the big picture.
That's a really good overview. Just maybe on that point there about social insurance and for digital nomads, you hit on something that I think is quite important, is that when somebody pays into a social insurance system, they are paying into, for example, from a US perspective, the right to a US social insurance pension in future. What's your recommendation for your clients when they have the option to pay that or perhaps structure their affairs such that they don't have to?
Well, if someone is nearing retirement, they need a few more quarters of contributions to get their full benefit, then it makes complete sense to pay Social Security and be able to collect the full benefits when they retire. Someone who's younger, in their 20s or 30s, I usually defer to them. It's their decision at the end of the day. If they were to move back to the US and have to pay Social Security later, then they would get full benefits and it might not be the best choice. But if they keep on staying outside of the US and, you know, all of their Social Security contributions will be voluntary in a way, then it might make sense to not contribute and save a similar amount invested on the stock market, and then they would have more at retirement.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's their personal lives and they incorporate their views as to where Social Security would be. And, you know, I cannot force them to save either. But if you're going to save on your Social Security taxes, you should put it in a securities account and invest it as opposed to spending it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a really important point, is that, you know, now when kind of people are digital nomads, it's brilliant. You know, it opens up so many possibilities, places you can travel and work and see the world and potentially have a low tax rate legitimately. But of course, I think you hit the nail on the head. Depending on how far away they are from retirement, it's always worth keeping one eye on, well, what will this look like in 20 years' time? And I mean, from an Irish US perspective, thankfully, there's a reciprocal agreement, which, you know, broadly ensures you only pay social insurance in one country at a time. And in addition to that, there's an aggregation of benefits paid in both jurisdictions in certain circumstances. But of course, these digital nomads are generally moving so frequently that they may not have the obligation to pay into the system in Ireland for the required amount of time. That's really interesting. Okay, so tell us then a little bit, the majority of your clients then, do they tend to be in that digital nomad space, or do you work predominantly with people who have relocated to places outside of the US permanently?
Yeah, actually, normally they have deeper roots in the country they're in, either in Canada or Western Europe. And then there's a lot more opportunities not to pay tax. As you mentioned, on the Social Security side, they would be able to use the totalization agreement, which means that regardless of the structure used, they would not be liable for Social Security. They would pay Social Security into the local system. And when it comes to income tax, in addition to the foreign income exclusion that I mentioned, where, by the way, they would be able to claim the bona fide residence test at that point because they would be actual residents of a foreign country, they can also use the foreign tax credit, which turns out to be more advantageous for those who live in countries with an higher tax rate.
Ah, okay. Okay, so they need to review their own situation. Do you see it common that digital nomads fail to get the foreign earned income exclusion and end up paying taxes in the US because of the fact that their movements are transient?
I mean, I haven't seen as many audits as you would expect, even though I advise them to keep a copy of their boarding pass and lease agreement and passport stamps. Take a photo with their phone because they can lose these things. It's much better to have a digital copy. But yes, they need to spend 330 days in a 12-month period in a foreign country. So that's something that they need to be mindful of before the fact. Because after the fact, they cannot change the past and they are probably not in a situation where they can use the bona fide residence test or the foreign tax credit.
Okay. No, I that's it's interesting. I wasn't aware of that previously. In terms of the clients that you deal with, obviously they're all US citizens. I know we spoke briefly before we started to record about the implications of renouncing citizenship. And I suppose one thing that goes through my mind when we talk about, for example, this cohort of digital nomads who are struggling to leave the US tax net, irrespective of the fact that they're not in the US. And then this second group of people who, you know, leave the US, go and live somewhere permanently. You know, in our case, that's Ireland in many cases. When and why and how, and that's three questions in one, would somebody hand back or consider renouncing their US citizenship? Talk us through why they might do it, what it looks like, and how they go about it.
Well, it's typically more of the second group that you mentioned. That would be people who have set their lives in a foreign country, have lived there for decades, have a second citizenship, don't really see them moving back to the US, tend to be older. The main benefit of US citizenship is the ability to live and work in the US. And when someone's in their 20s, they don't know where their career and their personal lives will take them. Whereas as people get older, not only are they more settled in their country of residence, but they also tend to have more complicated financial lives. They tend to have more investment income, etc., things that are more complicated from a US tax perspective. So then it makes more sense for them to renounce. Digital nomads, for starters, won't naturally get another citizenship because they don't create enough ties with a foreign country. Every now and then you see someone who would buy a citizenship by investment and then give up US citizenship without being settled anywhere in particular. That's definitely possible, and I have a few clients like that, but by and large, expatriates who regularly live in a foreign country outnumber them.
One of the things that comes to my mind is I rarely see my clients renounce US citizenship. Is that in the Irish-US situation, Irish tax rates tend to be higher most of the time at an individual level.
Right.
And therefore, the way the double tax agreement works is, save for the fact that the savings clause in the treaty says this treaty doesn't apply to US citizens, it does, as I understand it, allow a credit mechanism that you alluded to earlier, whereby there will be credit in either Ireland or the US for tax. So they're not doubly taxed. Mechanism for that application depends. But I suppose when you're coming to a higher tax jurisdiction like Ireland, I often explain to my clients, well, you're going to walk away from the transaction in most cases, having paid the Irish rate. The US may have taken some of it, Ireland will take the rest, but what hits your pocket is the Irish rate. So what I'm trying to say in a long-winded way is, being a US citizen isn't costing them any more money in this scenario. In other words, they have to pay Irish taxes if they want to live here, the US taxes are lower, it's a bit mute. I would imagine you're more likely to see people renouncing their US citizenship if they're moving to a low tax jurisdiction. In other words, a lower tax jurisdiction than the US. Is that what you would see practically?
Definitely people who pay less tax elsewhere, earn more than the foreign income exclusion, would have more of an incentive to give up US citizenship. But actually, it's not really the tax owing that leads them to... I mean, speaking about people in Canada and Western Europe, it's not the tax owing per se that leads them to renounce their citizenship. It's the cost of filing tax returns, the amount they pay their accountant. It's the restrictions it creates on their financial lives. Foreign mutual funds can be considered PFIC and be subject to a punitive tax regime. They have to avoid mutual funds. In many places, the sale of a principal residence is tax-free, whereas in the US, only the first $250,000 of capital gain is tax-free. If you held real estate in Toronto, for instance, for a decade, your capital gains would be a lot more than $250,000. And if you have a foreign corporation, Canada has a regime that makes it advantageous to leave the earnings inside the corporation, whereas in the US, to avoid sub-parev GILTI income, which essentially will tax you personally for an income that you live inside the corporation. So to have a reasonable treatment on the US side, you need to distribute it to yourself in the form of wages or dividends, which goes against the Canadian tax rules, the Canadian tax incentives. It's not necessarily the amount of tax owing. It's the restrictions that it creates on their financial lives. They have to organize their financial affairs in such a way as to not be subject to a punitive US tax regimes whereby they would actually have US tax owing. I mean, to take that last example, for instance, you leave the money inside the corporation, you have taxable income in the US, you don't have taxable income in Canada or Ireland, so you didn't pay tax personally on that income because Canada or Ireland would not consider you to have had personal income. And since you didn't pay tax to that foreign country, you would not have a foreign tax credit. So it's all these restrictions it creates on their lives that lead them to renounce more than the amount of tax owing per se.
And these must be people who are confident they have no desire to live and work in the US again.
Right, yes.
Okay, yeah. Because at that point, they would need to... Actually, interesting question, and it's probably an immigration one. I'm assuming once you've renounced your citizenship, you then enter as a tourist. you join the tourist queue on at the airport. Yeah, you really are walking away from that right to live and work there. Wouldn't be done lightly in any event. What pitfalls are there? Tell us what the tax pitfalls are when you're renouncing citizenship. What do people need to be aware of before they run to a decision? What do you step them through when you're guiding a client?
Well, they need to determine whether they are so-called covered expatriates or not. Their sweet test, they need to be compliant with their 5 years of tax returns, which is, you know, the most straightforward. They need to have an average income tax liability over the prior 5 years of less than $170,000, which usually is not the issue because people in that category would also have a net wealth of more than $2 million, which is the test that would cause them to be a covered expatriate. And if they are covered expatriates, then they would be subject to the exit tax, a deemed disposition of all of their assets on the day they renounce. Also, if they make gifts to U.S. citizens, U.S. citizens recipients will have to pay the gift tax of 30% of that. And there are other negatives to that. So in the planning phase, they need to determine whether they are covered expatriates or not. And if so, if it's based on the asset test, which it usually is, they might want to gift assets to a spouse and renounce the year after once they're under that $2 million threshold to avoid that covered expatriate status.
Okay, yeah. That's interesting. There's a lot of consideration. So how do you normally guide someone through this? Your business is an online business. Do you engage with people online via consultation and advise them in this way to help them through this planning phase?
Yes, absolutely. We would typically start with a call similar to this and then exchange information on my secure portal to either prepare a tax return or advise on the situation. When it comes to announcing U.S. citizenship, I would refer them to the balance sheet that is found on page 2 of Form 8854 that will allow them to determine whether they have a net wealth of $2 million or not. And oftentimes people forget some of the assets they have and tend to underestimate their net wealth, not by malice, but they might not think about the true value of their pension, for instance.
So just to kind of refer to 8854, that's the form that needs to be completed to renounce citizenship, correct, from a tax perspective?
Right. So they would fill out various immigration forms with the consulate for the actual renunciation. And the next year, they would file their final tax return, a dual status return, along with Form 8854. And the IRS will look at that Form 8854 to determine whether they are covered expatriates or not.
And my understanding is that it's a mark-to-market exercise. So therefore, the valuation of the assets at the point of expatriation is what is taken into account. So, you know, upswings in the value of your assets, because, for example, the stock market has performed well, could, in theory, trip you over a threshold and cause a problem, if I've understood correctly, based on my previous experience with clients.
Yes, exactly. And if you have a client who's close to the $2 million mark and have volatile assets, I mean, stocks are one thing, cryptocurrencies are something else altogether, it might be a good idea to move them into cash for the day of the renunciation to ensure that they wouldn't get tripped over.
Yeah, of course. So planning in advance to ensure there's no exit tax surprises. Okay, that's really interesting. What other tips do you have for US expats who might be listening to this today? If you're speaking with somebody, let's say, who is planning a move to Ireland, they are a US citizen. and they have a portfolio, for example, of 401k accounts. They have maybe an IRA, mutual funds, ETFs, property in the US, and are about to take a job in Ireland. You know, just hypothetically, what are some of the things or tips or piece of advice you would give someone if you were trying to get them to take something away from this episode?
Well, that situation is quite straightforward, actually. They can keep all of these assets. Obviously, they would be taxed on the withdrawals from the 401k and the IRA when that takes place. Aside from that, I mean, their financial institutions might close their account when they're overseas. There's nothing illegal about them having an account in the US when they're in Ireland. But some institutions are more conservative on the KYC front. That's something to be mindful of.
And actually, sorry, just to interject there, because that's a common thing that we come across. So the KYC acronym is Know Your Client, which is for anti-money laundering purposes. So international standards around verifying who financial institutions are dealing with. And we experience that frequently where our clients will say either they're no longer allowed to invest or their financial manager or broker says, we can't deal with you anymore because now you don't have an address in the US. So you're right. And it tends to vary. Some of the finance houses will work with our clients if they're no longer in the US and others won't. So it's interesting that you make that very point because that's exactly our experience. And I think that's a real takeaway for clients who are planning the move is don't take for granted that your portfolio can continue to operate as if you had not left the US. It will depend on what your investment manager is willing to allow you to do while you're outside of the country.
Yes, exactly. It's not a tax rule. It's an anti-money laundering rule. And the bank does not have to close their client's account or freeze it. But when they see something they're not familiar with, they tend to err on the side of caution because they don't want to have to explain it to their regulators, right? The credit union that originally served the Department of State employees, so government employees work at U.S. consulates, is accepting outside clients. You need to buy an ACA membership, which costs $50 a year. But that's the one U.S. institution that I send people to when they cannot find another one. They're designed to deal with U.S. citizens who live overseas.
That's really interesting. So, okay, so it sounds like, and you know, that's where probably the majority of people fall is in that example that I gave with outliers, of course, people who have, you know, different business interests or structures in place. For you, what are the main piece of advice you give your clients if they are planning to leave the US? Because obviously your clients are all outside the US. What do you want them to know?
Well, as you mentioned, ultimately they will be paying Irish tax. So when it comes to planning retirement, investing in retirement products, they should look into Irish products as opposed to 401ks and IRAs. That deduction that was useful when they were in the US is no longer useful because it's all made on the premise that their tax rate will be less at retirement than it is now. And after using the foreign tax credit, their tax rate is essentially zero in the US. And be mindful if you're going to create a foreign corporation, be mindful of the subpar F and GILTI income rules I mentioned earlier. Someone who moves to Ireland as an employee, you know, would be a straightforward situation between the totalization agreement and the foreign tax credit. They won't owe tax. But someone who creates an Irish corporation would have a lot more opportunities to mess up, if you will.
Okay, so there needs to be advice on both sides, Irish and US. Yeah, I think really from an Irish perspective, some of the points you've made are valid in the context of Irish taxes. We say it time and time again on this podcast, but the value of taking advice before somebody moves can never be underestimated because of the differences in the rules between the US and Ireland. And I think you alluded to it there, but it's very true. A product that's designed to achieve tax efficiency in the eyes of the IRS doesn't necessarily hold weight as being a tax efficient product from the Irish Revenue Commissioner's perspective. So it's that disconnect between something created and invested in while you were resident and living in one state may not give you the outcome you anticipated when you bring it to another country. So to circumvent that possible pain, take advice beforehand, because with planning and time, we can often unwind or suggest alternative ways to continue to invest. And you've hit the nail on the head. How do people contact you, Olivier, if they want to work with you and your team?
Oh, they would go to 1040abroad.com. That's 1040abroad.com. And there's a contact form on the homepage, and we'll get back to you within 24 hours after you complete that.
Brilliant. So you guys obviously prepare tax returns. Do you provide written advice and obviously online consultations as well?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, similar to ourselves. It's been brilliant to talk with you. Thank you so much. I think there's quite a lot there in terms of what our listeners can take away, particularly if they're planning to renounce their citizenship or setting off for bluer skies elsewhere as a digital nomad. We've really enjoyed talking with you, and I'm sure our listeners will enjoy the episode as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Tax Bites for Expats. Please do leave a rating or review wherever you listen to your podcast. And as always, remember to take professional tax advice specific to your personal circumstances before acting or refraining from action in connection with the matters dealt with in this series. The material in this podcast is intended to give general guidance only.